In his book, The Abolition of Man, C.S. Lewis imagined a reader saying, quote, "You say we shall have no values at all if we step outside the Tao? Very well. We shall probably find that we can get on quite comfortably without them. Let us regard all ideas of what we ought to do simply as an interesting psychological survival. Let us step right out of all that and start doing what we like. Let us decide for ourselves what man is to be and make him into that, not on any ground of imagined value, but because we want him to be such. Having mastered our environment, let us now master ourselves and choose our own destiny." Close quote. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast. The quote I read is at the end of the second chapter of The Abolition of Man, our Wyoming Catholic College Book of the Year. In that chapter, Lewis argued that the Tao, or natural law, is essential for any morality, any sense of ought to. But what if we throw away morality? What if we allow no ought, no permanent values, nothing but what we as humans choose for ourselves in any given age? That question leads to the third and final part of the book, and the final abolition of man. In this, our third podcast about the abolition of man, our guest is Wyoming Catholic College Academic Dean, Dr. Jason Baxter. Dr. Baxter, it's only in the last part of the book that Lewis uses the phrase, the abolition of man. What is the abolition of man?
Lewis is afraid that a generation of human beings, perfectly situated between the past and the future, will achieve such a radical control and success over technology and engineering and education that they'll be able to shape men and women into the kind of creatures that they desire, at which point they will have a choice between choosing those values and virtues which have been traditionally human and a brand new set of technocratic virtues, or really whatever they want. And that's what he thinks. That's what he's afraid is, whether or not they choose to embrace the past virtues or reject them, the fact is they're in, even if they do choose them, they're in a situation so unlike anything which has ever occurred in history that he says basically humanity has been eclipsed. It's the abolition of man.
And from his point of view, how does that come about? Obviously, it doesn't happen overnight. How does man conquer and thus destroy man?
Well, part of it is just, as he says, he gives a nice little history. And obviously, this is Lewis drawing upon his own training as a medievalist and as what we now call the early modern period. He knows that there's this original period in which both science and magic were like twins born in the same era. And although magic is the weak, sickly twin and dies out, and science is the strong twin that continues to flourish, they basically seek the same impulse. In other words, rather than studying the world with attentiveness, with an expectation of delight and wonder, they look at the world as a series of mechanisms to be pulled in terms of increasing power and profitability. In a way, Uncle Andrew, the inept magician, and magician's nephew, is kind of a symbol for this, both what Lewis feels is the sort of scientific and magical mentality divorced from other kind of humanistic aesthetic impulses of beauty, truth, and ethics.
Yeah, Uncle Andrew, when he sees the creation of Narnia, simply says, "Man, we can make some money here."
Is exactly right, and that in Lewis's mind is sort of a science which is unharnessed from traditional values. Mm-hmm. Is no better than a magic which is seeking to put man in power over the natural environment which surrounds him, as opposed to the other way around, in which study and ethics sought to conform man's powers and spirit and soul to the environment around him. It sort of reverses the relationship and establishes one of power as opposed to one of goodness.
Lewis wrote in The Abolition of Man, "Traditional values are to be debunked, and mankind is to be cut out into some fresh shape at the will, which must, by hypothesis, be an arbitrary will, of some few lucky people in one lucky generation, which has learned how to do it." Is that the inevitable result of forsaking the Tao?
Right. Well, I think Lewis's argument is really subtle. He has a suspicion that people will forsake the Tao and they will do it voluntarily. But whether or not they do, the fact is they're going to be in a weird position in which, for the first time ever, if they decide to choose the Tao, they're choosing it for different reasons than anyone else ever has before. They're not choosing it because it's true and beautiful and written into the order of things, but they're choosing it because it's effective and valuable for whatever purposes that they've done so. So I think that's the subtlety of Lewis's argument. Lewis, though, I mean, being a good historian, says, look, I mean, when you read old books of history, anytime who steps outside of, you know, this traditional ethical system, right, this belief that ethics and beauty are written into the world, what he calls the Tao, for persuasive argumentative strategies. You know, he says people have stepped outside of that before, of course, but never as a whole culture. And anytime they do, they become supremely debased and wicked. That's what he suspects will happen. But at least I like the subtlety of his argument, is that even if we do choose traditional virtues and values, we're choosing them for an extremely different reason, and something will be lost even if we look and practice like what our ancestors looked and practiced like.
Well, and that's in fact happening. We're finding among more better educated and wealthier Americans all the choices for a traditional lifestyle. Dad working, mom at home, children waiting until after marriage to have the children, staying married, and so on and so forth. But it's not being chosen because that's the Tao, because that's the right thing, because that's in accord with reality. It's being chosen because it just happens to work and bring about financial and family success.
Right. Yeah. Well, I suppose in the meantime, if you, going back to the first chapter of Abolition of Man, it sort of hollows out those choices. It sort of makes those choices sort of mere brain against ignoring the thumonic virtues of, you know, what Lewis calls the chest.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to look back at the first chapter. The book began talking about the Green Book, a text for high school students, and ends with something of an apocalyptic note. Is it fair that he goes from sort of lightweight subjectivity to heavyweight tyranny of those he calls the conditioners? Is that being fair, or is that just sort of dire?
It makes sense to me. I mean, it seems that the route by which Lewis arrives at that is that in that generation that truly believes in its subjectivity, it believes that it has arrived at a kind of place of emancipation and liberation in which old values are suggestions. But what we really have to do is sort of sketch our own lives out in our total freedom. Again, I think Lewis's fear is that how long will it take for a generation to be born in which it feels completely liberated and free, and then just takes advantage of the opportunity to impose their version of freedom upon everyone else.
At the end of the last chapter, and therefore at the end of the book, Lewis says, "If you see through everything, then everything is transparent. But a wholly transparent world is an invisible world. To see through all things is the same as not to see." Why does he end the book there?
Right. Lewis is imagining the situation in which there are no ends. In other words, there's no sort of final resting point. There's no basic and fundamental principle for which all other things are being done. Right. I mean, if you tell your child you should get a good education, and the child says, "Why?" And you say, "Because you'll get a good job." And if the child says, "Why should I have a good job?" And you say, "Because you'll have a nice income." And the child says, "Why should I have a nice income?" And say, "Well, because you'll have a great capacity to choose and purchase things." And then the child asks that one final difficult question: "And why would I want to have a great capacity to choose things?" I think Lewis imagines that kind of situation in which it's a see-through world, it's all invisible. We don't know why we're doing what we're doing anymore. And thus, these controllers, these designers, have been reduced to mere impulse, which he, you know, tongue-in-cheek says is the complete victory of nature. We've, in some sense, the feigned retreat of nature, he says. in some sense, we keep overcoming her, tearing her secrets from her in order to gain more power. But when we've gained complete power and have come to the position which the world is see-through, by which I mean we have no ends, no reasons for doing things, then those few people, those designers, those controllers, are left to their whim. In other words, they're mere naturalistic impulses.
How close are we today to the abolition of man from your point of view?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel less gloomy than Lewis does. I don't know if I have very good reasons. I think one of the things I had forgotten about this chapter until I reread it a couple of times is how at the same time, though it's bleak and apocalyptic, it's also hopeful. Lewis has some really interesting parallels, for example, with some of the things that he's doing in his other late books, like Miracles, and in which he speculates on what if we had a good natural philosophy. Lewis was, I think, a lot more interested in science than we oftentimes give him credit for. And I think when he begins to speculate on that in fact the answer might even come from science itself, that maybe there's a way of sort of practicing modern science which is also in tune with the aesthetic, with the ethical, right, which will reestablish our ability to see. And so Lewis and his friend Barfield imagined this age, this original age in which man was mythological, and then an age in which man was sort of scientific and logical, and I think he sort of feels us at the very end of that. Now, his friend Barfield speculated that there would be a time in history in which the mythological and scientific impulses would come back together. So I think that, although I think Lewis believes it's a real threat, that this sort of, you know, apocalyptic, I think he's equally hopeful, and I think this is where his Christian virtue of hope comes back, that we might have just been brought to a time where it looks wayless, it looks hopeless, in order for the Christian virtues of faith and hope to actually have a meaningful opportunity to be redeployed.
What we call man's power over nature, concluded C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man, turns out to be a power exercised by some men over other men, with nature as its instrument. Scholar Alan Jacobs comments in his book, The Year of Our Lord, 1943, quote, Lewis makes this claim because the most powerful technologies are never universally distributed, but are always in the hands of a powerful few, who typically use them in order to maintain and extend their control over the many, close quote. At Wyoming Catholic College, we have the audacious faith to believe that through our unique undergraduate education, our distance learning courses, the annual Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, and these after-dinner scholar podcasts, we're facing down those who would replace the Tao, the natural way the world and human beings work, with what is little more than human willfulness and the desire to dominate others. Here at the end of 2019, will you help support our efforts with a gift to underwrite the cost of producing and distributing these podcasts? Visit wyomingcatholic.edu/podcast to make your end-of-the-year gift today. Thank you in advance for your generosity. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.